This is America Weekend. I am Paul Harris. Thanks so much for listening. When you go to vote for President of the United States, which you don't have to do this year, you got a couple years, calm down. When you do that every time, you're not actually voting directly for the person whose name appears on that ballot. You are voting for the electors for that person. And those electors are decided in each state based on, well, a multitude of different ways. Sometimes it's by precinct, sometimes it's by state. But it never goes to the point where whoever gets the most votes in the entire country gets to be president. It hasn't been that way because that's the way it's set up in Article 2, Section 1 of the United States Constitution. You may remember back in 2000 how this became a big deal when we had Bush v. Gore, and it all came down to 527 votes in Florida determining whether Florida's electors should vote for Bush or for Gore. And, of course, it went to the Supreme Court, and there's been a lot of debate about it since. There was actually a lot of debate about it even before then, because that was not the first time that the person who got the most national votes did not end up becoming president of the United States because of the Electoral College. But now there's an effort to change that forever, something called the National Popular Vote Compact. My next guest has been writing about this in the Daily Beast. Ben Jacobs, welcome to America Weekend.
Thanks for having me.
Does it all go back to 2000, or, as I said, was this a controversy that was broiling for years?
This has been a controversy that's been going on for, you know, decades, that there was actually a proposed constitutional amendment in 1970 that passed the House and was endorsed by President Nixon, but didn't make it past the filibuster in the Senate, which was then 67 votes, and they got a majority of the senators, but not 67, and it didn't make it to the states.
All right.
So that these proposals have been around for decades, but really 2000 was what gave the impetus to this, which is essentially a workaround.
Okay. This does not involve a constitutional amendment. Explain what the workaround would be.
That the workaround is that states totaling 270 electoral votes, a majority of the electoral votes, passed a bill saying that whoever wins the popular vote gets their electors. So that, for example, New York is the most recent state to do this. They passed a vote saying whoever has the, you know, that if they get 270 signed onto the compact, then whoever gets the most popular votes, not who wins the state of New York, gets New York's electors.
Oh, so when you say whoever gets the most popular votes, you don't mean by state anymore. You're talking about we have to count all the votes from across the country before any state in this compact decides who gets their electors.
Yes. Yes, that's precisely the case. That the idea is that you can change the Electoral College, that a constitutional amendment, you know, it's hard enough to pass a bill in Congress these days, that a constitutional amendment would be impossible, and that this would be a workaround based on the fact that the states constitutionally have the power to direct our electors who to vote for, so that you'd have situations where once it's determined who won the popular vote nationally, then regardless of who won the state, the legislature, you know, sends instructions to the electors vote for candidate X.
Okay, so you mentioned that New York is the most recent to do this. How many states have done it so far, and how close are we to fixing this problem?
10 states have done it, totaling 165 electoral votes out of 270, which is a majority, and that it's been going at a pace of about a state every year and a half. Right now, it's all been Democratic states, that the initial impetus came from liberals concerned about 2000, but it sort of cut across party lines. New York, this was actually scored by the Conservative Party, which is a right-wing third party, is one of their most important votes of the session.
Interesting.
Cuts across party lines a little bit.
Okay, so what about the red states? Are they even considering it?
Yes, some red states are moving through it, that it's passed one chamber in Oklahoma, and it's under discussion in other conservative states because, first of all, the idea, you know, that I think those folks in those states are a little bit more skeptical, but it has a lot of appeal there, that if you're in Oklahoma or Mississippi or Texas even, presidential candidates aren't going to be coming to your state. That the idea is cutting across party lines and that no one's making any appeals to their voters, and that this is all coming down to voters in Ohio, in Florida, Florida and a handful of other states.
Right. It's the swing states that get all the attention because they're the ones who are going to do it. The ones that are already decided wouldn't have any input. How would this change that?
This would change it. This would mean that if elections are decided by popular vote, then folks are targeting swing voters across the country, not swing voters in swing states. That swing voter in Maryland or a swing voter in Montana becomes just as important as one in Michigan, that you end up having a broad national campaign that you're emphasizing turnout in areas. You know, Democrats would be trying to turn out the vote in New York City. Republicans would be trying to turn out the vote in West Texas, and would nationalize presidential campaigns and remove the focus on, you know, these 5 to 10 swing states.
Wouldn't it, however, move the attention to the 5 or 10 biggest states in the country? So, for instance, California, our most populous state, which usually doesn't really have much to do with it, and we already know who the president is going to be before even some of those people get out of work and go to the polls, that their vote would actually seem to count more, and maybe candidates would have to spend more time there and in other more populous places like Texas.
Well, that's certainly one argument put forward. The counter to that is, you know, you're just targeting voters. You're not targeting states. It doesn't matter if a voter's within a particular state or not. States are irrelevant. So that at that point, you know, so you're finding the patches of voters in California, or you're finding a patch, you know, north in Oregon or across in Nevada, that it's not about states. It's probably as much about media markets and about specific demographic groups and economic groups that folks are targeting.
I wonder how people in Mississippi, one of our reddest states, would feel if a Democrat won the national popular vote and therefore Mississippi was blue.
I think that would be interesting thought scenario for them. Mississippi, yeah, is a state where there are huge pockets of Democrats, and even though it's a very Republican state, and the argument would be Mississippi would now get those folks paid attention to.
Yeah, well, it would probably cause a ruckus. But I also would think that people now who live in non-swing states, like a solidly red state or a solidly blue state, they might not even vote now, figuring, well, it doesn't matter because my state's going to go one way and our electors are going to go to that party anyway. I think if you made it based on the national popular vote, we might actually get more people to vote.
That's entirely possible. You know, one of the arguments put forward by the proponents of this. And it would be, you know, interesting to see how that happens, because it's hard to compare, because there's not an electoral college used for anything else in the country. You can't do a study to check, but that would seem to be a fair assumption.
What do you think this would do to things like the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire's place as the first in the nation primary in presidential season?
That's a good question. That this only, of course, affects the general election, and that's those are primary contests, that there's been some pressure for a national one-day primary in the past. But, you know, if this happened, that this may actually strengthen their hold as the one way to measure things state by state. But it's still a little bit, you know, that would be two steps ahead, and it's hard to guess once that happens.
Yeah, we can't even figure out when to vote. Some places do it by mail for a couple of weeks ahead of time. Other places, you can only vote on that Tuesday. Other people want to move the election day to a weekend. We can't even do that. But this would seem to be something that would be relatively simple once it gets done, but they have to get past a lot of hurdles between now and then. You said it's only been one state or so, maybe one and a half states per year. It doesn't seem like this is going to happen by 2016, Ben.
No, it certainly won't happen by 2016. But there's the potential for it being on pace to happen, provided that you would need a state like Texas to jump in by 2020. That's roughly the pace it's on right now. It's a question of whether it could pick up, because it's already included big, big states like California, New York, and Illinois. But that, you know, assuming that everything proceeds at pace, that it theoretically could reach 270 by then.
Very interesting. Well, we'll see what happens in those state legislatures, and if it can move forward from there, this could be something that impacts us into the next generation of voters. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ben Jacobs, who's been writing about this for the Daily Beast. If you want to find out more about this, it's the National Popular Vote Compact. Just Google that and you'll get all the information. I'm Paul Harris. This show's called America Weekend, on the air every Saturday and Sunday from the Envision Networks.